was converted to a stain and fault. She makes her way toward the future, wounded, shamed, worried, and guilty. Chapter 2. The Girl. Throughout her childhood, the little girl was bullied and mutilated, but she nonetheless grasped herself as an autonomous individual. In her relations with her family and friends, in her studies and games, she saw herself in the present as a transcendence. Her future passivity was something she only imagined. Once she enters puberty, the future not only moves closer, it settles into her body. It becomes the most concrete reality. It retains the fateful quality it always had. While the adolescent boy is actively rooted toward adulthood, the girl looks forward to the opening of this new and unforeseeable period where the plot is already hatched and toward which time is drawing her. As she is already detached from her childhood past, the present is for her only a transition. She sees no valid ends in it, only occupations. In a more or less disguised way, her youth is consumed by waiting. She is waiting for man. Surely the adolescent boy also dreams of woman. He desires her. But she will never be more than one element in his life. She does not encapsulate his destiny. From childhood, the little girl, whether wishing to realize herself as woman or overcome the limits of her femininity, has awaited the male for accomplishment and escape. He has the dazzling face of Perseus or St. George. He is the liberator. He is also rich and powerful. He holds the keys to happiness. He is Prince Charming. She anticipates that in his caress she will feel carried away by the great current of life, as when she rested in her mother's bosom. Subjected to his gentle authority, she will find the same security as in her father's arms. The magic of embraces and gazes will petrify her back into an idol. She has always been convinced of male superiority. This male prestige is not a childish mirage. It has economic and social foundations. Men are, without any question, the masters of the world. Everything convinces the adolescent girl that it is in her interest to be their vassal. Her parents prod her on. The father is proud of his daughter's success. The mother sees the promise of a prosperous future. Friends envy and admire the one among them who gets the most masculine admiration. In American colleges, the student's status is based on the number of dates she has. Marriage is not only an honorable and less strenuous career than many others. It alone enables woman to attain her complete social dignity and also to realize herself sexually as lover and mother. This is the role her entourage thus envisages for her future, as she envisages it herself. Everyone unanimously agrees that catching a husband, or a protector in some cases, is for her the most important of undertakings. In her eyes, man embodies the other, as she does for man. But for her, this other appears in the essential mode, and she grasps herself as the inessential opposite him. She will free herself from her parents' home, from her mother's hold. She will open up her future not by an act of conquest, but by passively and docilely delivering herself into the hands of a new master. It has often been declared that if she resigns herself to this surrender, it is because physically and morally she has become inferior to boys and incapable of competing with them. Forsaking hopeless competition, she entrusts the assurance of her happiness to a member of the superior caste. In fact, her humility does not stem from a given inferiority. On the contrary, her humility engenders all her failings. Its source is in the adolescent girl's past, in the society around her, and precisely in this future that is proposed to her. True, puberty transforms the girl's body. It is more fragile than before. Female organs are vulnerable. They're functioning delicate, strange and uncomfortable. Breasts are a burden. They remind her of their presence during strenuous exercise. They quiver. They ache. From here on, woman's muscle force, endurance, and suppleness are inferior to man's. Hormonal imbalances create nervous and vasomotor instability. menstrual periods are painful. Headaches, stiffness, and abdominal cramps make normal activities painful and even impossible. Added to these discomforts are psychic problems. Nervous and irritable, the woman frequently undergoes a state of semi-alienation each month. Central control of the nervous and sympathetic systems is no longer assured. Circulation problems and some auto-intoxications turn the body into a screen between the woman and the world, a burning fog that weighs on her, stifling her and separating her. Experienced through this suffering and passive flesh, the entire universe is a burden too heavy to bear. Oppressed and submerged, she becomes a stranger to herself because she is a stranger to the rest of the world. Syntheses disintegrate. Instants are no longer connected. Others are recognized, but only abstractly. And if reasoning and logic do remain intact, as in melancholic delirium, they are subordinated to passions that surge out of organic disorder. These facts are extremely important, but the way the woman becomes conscious of them gives them their weight. At about 13, boys serve a veritable apprenticeship in violence, developing their aggressiveness, their will for power, and their taste for competition. It is exactly at this moment that the little girl renounces rough games. Some sports remain accessible to her, but sport that is specialization, submission to artificial rules, does not offer the equivalent of a spontaneous and habitual recourse to force. It is marginal to life. It does not teach about the world and about oneself as intimately as does an unruly fight or an impulsive rock climb. The sportswoman never feels the conqueror's pride of the boy who pins down his comrade. In fact, in many countries, most girls have no athletic training. Like fights, climbing is forbidden to them. They only submit to their bodies passively. Far more clearly than in their early years, they must forego emerging beyond the given world, affirming themselves above the rest of humanity. They are banned from exploring, daring, pushing back the limits of the possible. In particular, the attitude of defiance, so important for boys, is unknown to them. True, women compare themselves with each other, but defiance is something other than these passive confrontations. Two freedoms confront each other as having a hold on the world whose limits they intend to push. Climbing higher than a friend or getting the better in arm wrestling is affirming one's sovereignty over the world. These conquering actions are not permitted to the girl, and violence in particular is not permitted to her. Undoubtedly, in the adult world, brute force plays no great role in normal times, but it nonetheless haunts the world. Much of masculine behavior arises in a setting of potential violence. On every street corner, skirmishes are waiting to happen. In most cases, they are aborted. But it is enough for the man to feel in his fists his will for self-affirmation, for him to feel confirmed in his sovereignty. The male has recourse to his fists and fighting when he encounters any affront or attempt to reduce him to an object. He does not let himself be transcended by others. He finds himself again in the heart of his subjectivity. Violence is the authentic test of every person's attachment to himself, his passions, and his own will. To radically reject it is to reject all objective truth. It is to isolate oneself in an abstract subjectivity. An anger or a revolt that does not exert itself in muscles remains imaginary. It is a terrible frustration not to be able to imprint the movements of one's heart on the face of the earth. In the South of the United States, it is strictly impossible for a black person to use violence against whites. This rule is the key to the mysterious black soul. The way the black experiences himself in the white world, his behavior in adjusting to it, the compensations he seeks, his whole way of feeling and acting are explained on the basis of the passivity to which he is condemned. During the occupation, the French who had decided not to let themselves resort to violent gestures against the occupants, even in cases of provocation, whether out of egotistical prudence or because they had overriding duties, felt their situation in the world profoundly overturned. Depending upon the whims of others, they could be changed into objects, their subjectivity, no longer had the means to express itself concretely. It was merely a secondary phenomenon. In the same way, for the adolescent boy who was allowed to manifest himself imperiously, the universe has a totally different face from what it has for the adolescent girl whose feelings are deprived of immediate effectiveness. The former ceaselessly calls the world into question. He can, at every instance, revolt against the given, and thus has the impression of actively confirming it when he accepts it. The latter only submits to it. The world is defined without her, and its face is immutable. This lack of physical power expresses itself as a more general timidity. She does not believe in a force she has not felt in her body. She does not dare to be enterprising, to revolt, to invent. Doomed to docility, to resignation, she can only accept a place that society has already made for her. She accepts the order of things as a given. A woman told me that all through her youth, she denied her physical weakness with fierce bad faith. To accept it would have been to lose her taste and courage to undertake anything, even in intellectual or political fields. I knew a girl brought up as a tomboy and exceptionally vigorous who thought she was as strong as a man. Though she was very pretty, though she had painful periods every month, she was completely unconscious of her femininity. She had a boy's toughness, exuberance of life and initiative. She had a boy's boldness. On the street, she would not hesitate to jump into a fistfight if she saw a child or a woman harassed. One or two bad experiences revealed to her that brute force is on the male side. When she became aware of her weakness, a great part of her assurance crumbled. This was the beginning of an evolution that led her to feminize herself, to realize herself as passivity, to accept dependence. To lose confidence in one's body is to lose confidence in oneself. One needs only to see the importance that young men give to their muscles to understand that every subject grasps his body as his objective expression. The young man's erotic drives only go to confirm the pride that he obtains from his body. He discovers in it the sign of transcendence and its power. The girl can succeed in accepting her desires, but most often they retain a shameful nature. Her whole body is experienced as embarrassment. The defiance she felt as a child regarding her insides contributes to giving the menstrual crisis the dubious nature that renders it loathsome. The psychic attitude evoked by menstrual servitude constitutes a heavy handicap. The threat that weighs on the girl during certain periods can seem so intolerable for her that she will give up expeditions and pleasures out of fear of her disgrace becoming known. The horror that this inspires has repercussions on her organism and increases her disorders and pains. It has been seen that one of the characteristics of female physiology is the tight link between endocrinal secretions and the nervous system. There is reciprocal action. A woman's body, and specifically the girl's, is a hysterical body in the sense that there is, so to speak, no distance between psychic life and its physiological realization. The turmoil brought about by the girl's discovery of the problems of puberty exacerbates them. Because her body is suspect to her, she scrutinizes it with anxiety and sees it as sick. It is sick. It has been seen that indeed this body is fragile and real organic disorders arise. But gynecologists concur that 9/10 of their patients have imaginary illnesses. That is, either their illnesses have no physiological reality or the organic disorder itself stems from a psychic attitude. To a great extent, the anguish of being a woman eats away at the female body. It is clear that if woman's biological situation constitutes a handicap for her, it is because of the perspective from which it is grasped. Nervous frailty and vasomotor instability, when they do not become pathological, do not keep her from any profession. Among males themselves, there is a great diversity of temperament. A 1 or 2 day indisposition per month, even painful, is not an obstacle either. In fact, many women accommodate themselves to it, particularly women for whom the monthly curse could be most bothersome, athletes, travelers, and women who do strenuous work. Most professions demand no more energy than women can provide. And in sports, the goal is not to succeed independently of physical aptitudes. It is the accomplishment of perfection proper to each organism. The lightweight champion is as worthy as the heavyweight. A female ski champion is no less a champion than the male who is more rapid than she. They belong to two different categories. It is precisely athletes who, positively concerned with their own accomplishments, feel the least handicapped in comparison to men. But nonetheless, her physical weakness does not allow the woman to learn the lessons of violence. If it were possible to assert herself in her body and be part of the world in some other way, this deficiency would be easily compensated. If she could swim, scale rocks, pilot a plane, battle the elements, take risks, and venture out, she would not feel the timidity toward the world that I spoke about. It is within the whole context of a situation that leaves her few outlets that these singularities take on their importance, and not immediately, but by confirming the inferiority complex that was developed in her by her childhood. It is this complex as well that will weigh on her intellectual accomplishments. It has often been noted that from puberty, the girl loses ground in intellectual and artistic fields. There are many reasons for this. One of the most common is that the adolescent girl does not receive the same encouragement accorded to her brothers. On the contrary, she is expected to be a woman as well, and she must add to her professional work the duties that femininity implies. The headmistress of a professional school made these comments on the subject. The girl suddenly becomes a being who earns her living by working. She has new desires that have nothing to do with the family. It very often happens that she must make quite a considerable effort. She gets home at night exhausted, her head stuffed with the day's events. How will she be received? Her mother sends her right out to do an errand. There are home chores left unfinished to do, and she still has to take care of her own clothes. It is impossible to disconnect from the personal thoughts that continue to preoccupy her. She feels unhappy and compares her situation with that of her brother, who has no duties at home, and she revolts. Note, cited by Liebman, Youth and Sexuality. Housework or everyday chores that the mother does not hesitate to impose on the girl student or trainee completely exhaust her. During the war, I saw my students in Sèvres worn out by family tasks added on top of their schoolwork. One developed Pott's disease, the other meningitis. Mothers, we will see, are blindly hostile to freeing their daughters and, more or less deliberately, work at bullying them even more. For the adolescent boy, his effort to become a man is respected, and he is already granted great freedom. The girl is required to stay home. Her outside activities are watched over. She is never encouraged to organize her own fun and pleasure. It is rare to see women organize a long hike on their own, a walking or biking trip, or take part in games such as billiards and bowling. Beyond a lack of initiative that comes from their education, customs make their independence difficult. If they wander the streets, they are stared at, accosted. I know of some girls, far from shy, who get no enjoyment strolling through Paris alone because, incessantly bothered, they are incessantly on their guard. All their pleasure is ruined. If girl students run through the streets in happy groups as boys do, they attract attention, striding along, singing, talking, and laughing loudly, or eating an apple are provocations, and they will be insulted or followed or approached. Lightheartedness immediately becomes a lack of decorum. This self-control imposed on the woman becomes second nature for the well-bred girl and kills spontaneity. Lively exuberance is crushed. The result is tension and boredom. This boredom is contagious. Girls tire of each other quickly. Being in the same prison does not create solidarity among them, and this is one of the reasons the company of boys becomes so necessary. This inability to be self-sufficient brings on a shyness that extends over their whole lives and even marks their work. They think that brilliant triumphs are reserved for men. They do not dare aim too high. It has already been observed that 15-year-old girls comparing themselves with boys declare, "Boys are better." This conviction is debilitating. It encourages laziness and mediocrity. A girl, who had no particular deference for the stronger sex, reproached a man for his cowardice. When she was told that she herself was a coward, she complacently declared, "Oh, it's not the same thing for a woman." The fundamental reason for this defeatism is that the adolescent girl does not consider herself responsible for her future. She judges it useless to demand much of herself, since her lot, in the end, will not depend on her. Far from destining herself to man because she thinks she is inferior to him, it is because she is destined for him that, in accepting the idea of her inferiority, she constitutes it. In fact, she will gain value in the eyes of males not by increasing her human worth, but by modeling herself on their dreams. When she is inexperienced, she is not always aware of this. She sometimes acts as aggressively as boys. She tries to conquer them with a brusque authority, a proud frankness. This attitude is almost surely doomed to failure. From the most servile to the haughtiest, girls all learn that to please, they must give in to them. Their mothers urge them not to treat boys like companions, not to make advances to them, to assume a passive role. If they want to flirt or initiate a friendship, they should carefully avoid giving the impression they are taking the initiative. Men do not like tomboys, nor blue stockings, nor thinking women. Too much audacity, culture, intelligence, or character frightens them. In most novels, as George Eliot observes, it is the dumb blonde heroine who outshines the virile brunette. And in The Mill on the Floss, Maggie tries in vain to reverse the roles. In the end, she dies, and it is blonde Lucy who marries Stephen. In The Last of the Mohicans, vapid Alice wins the hero's heart, and not valiant Cora. In Little Women, kindly Joe is only a childhood friend for Laurie. He vows his love to curly-haired and insipid Amy. To be feminine is to show oneself as weak, futile, passive, and docile. The girl is supposed not only to primp and dress herself up, but also to repress her spontaneity and substitute for it the grace and charm she has been taught by her elder sisters. Any self-assertion will take away from her femininity and her seductiveness. A young man's venture into existence is relatively easy, as his vocations of human being and male are not contradictory. His childhood already predicted this happy fate. It is in accomplishing himself as independence and freedom that he acquires his social value and, concurrently, his manly prestige. The ambitious man, like Rastignac, targets money, glory, and women all at once. One of the stereotypes that stimulates him is that of the powerful and famous man adored by women. For the girl, on the contrary, there is a divorce between her properly human condition and her feminine vocation. This is why adolescence is such a difficult and decisive moment for woman. Until then, she was an autonomous individual. She now has to renounce her sovereignty. Not only is she torn like her brothers, and more acutely, between past and future, but in addition, a conflict breaks out between her originary claim to be subject, activity, and freedom on the one hand, and, on the other, her erotic tendencies and the social pressure to assume herself as a passive object. She spontaneously grasps herself as the essential. How will she decide to become the inessential? If I can accomplish myself only as the other, how will I renounce myself? Such is the agonizing dilemma the woman-to-be must struggle with, wavering from desire to disgust, from hope to fear, rebuffing what she invites, she is still suspended between the moment of childish independence and that of feminine submission. This is the incertitude that, as she grows out of the awkward age, gives her the bitter taste of unripe fruit. The girl reacts to her situation differently depending on her earlier choices. The little woman, the matron-to-be, can easily resign herself to her metamorphosis. But she may also have drawn a taste for authority from her condition as little woman that lets her rebel against the masculine yoke. She is ready to establish a matriarchy, not to become an erotic object and servant. This will often be the case of those older sisters who took on important responsibilities at a young age. The tomboy, upon becoming a woman, often feels a burning disappointment that can drive her directly to homosexuality. But what she was looking for in independence and intensity was to possess the world. She may not want to renounce the power of her femininity, the experiences of maternity, a whole part of her destiny. Generally, with some resistance, the girl consents to her femininity, already at the stage of childish coquetry in front of her father, in her erotic fantasies. She understood the charm of passivity. She discovers the power in it. Vanity is soon mixed with the shame that her flesh inspires. That hand that moves her, that glance that excites her, they're an appeal, an invitation. Her body seems endowed with magic virtues. It is a treasure, a weapon. She is proud of it. Her coquetry, which often has disappeared during her years of childhood autonomy, is revived. She tries makeup, hairstyles. Instead of hiding her breasts, she massages them to make them bigger. She studies her smile in the mirror. The link is so tight between arousal and seduction that in all cases where erotic sensibility lies dormant, no desire to please is observed in the subject. Experiments have shown that patients suffering from a thyroid deficiency, and thus apathetic and sullen, can be transformed by an injection of glandular extracts. They begin to smile. They become gay and simpering. Psychologists imbued with materialistic metaphysics have boldly declared flirtatiousness an instinct secreted by the thyroid gland. But this obscure explanation is no more valid here than for early childhood. The fact is that in all cases of organic deficiency, lymphatism, anemia, and such, the body is endured as a burden, foreign, hostile. It neither hopes for nor promises anything. When it recovers its equilibrium and vitality, the subject at once recognizes it as his, and through it, he transcends toward others. For the girl, erotic transcendence consists in making herself prey in order to make a catch. She becomes an object, and she grasps herself as object. She is surprised to discover this new aspect of her being. It seems to her that she has been doubled. Instead of coinciding exactly with herself, here she is existing outside of herself. Thus, in Rosamund Lehmann's Invitation to the Waltz, Olivia discovers an unknown face in the mirror. It is she object, suddenly rising up opposite herself. She experiences a quickly fading but upsetting emotion. Nowadays, a peculiar emotion accompanied the moment of looking in the mirror. Fitfully, rarely, a stranger might emerge, a new self. It had happened 2 or 3 times already. She looked in the glass and saw herself. Well, what was it? But this was something else. This was a mysterious face, both dark and glowing, hair tumbling down, pushed back and upwards, as if in currents of fierce energy. Was it the frock that did it? Her body seemed to assemble itself harmoniously within it, to become centralized, to expand, both static and fluid, alive. It was the portrait of a young girl in pink. All the room's reflected objects seemed to frame, to present her, whispering, "Here are you." What astonishes Olivia are the promises she thinks she reads in this image, in which she recognizes her childish dreams, and which is herself. But the girl also cherishes in her carnal presence this body that fascinates her, as if it were someone else's. She caresses herself. She embraces the curve of her shoulder, the bend of her elbow. She contemplates her bosom, her legs. Solitary pleasure becomes a pretext for reverie. In it, she seeks a tender self-possession. For the boy adolescent, there is an opposition between love of oneself and the erotic movement that thrusts him toward the object to be possessed. His narcissism generally disappears at the moment of sexual maturity. Instead of the woman being a passive object for the lover as for herself, there is a primitive blurring in her eroticism. In one complex step, she aims for her body's glorification through the homage of men for whom this body is intended. And it would be a simplification to say that she wants to be beautiful in order to charm, or that she seeks to charm to assure herself that she is beautiful. In the solitude of her room, in salons where she tries to attract the gaze of others, she does not separate man's desire from the love of her own self. This confusion is manifest in Marie Bashkirtseff. Note, I am the most interesting book of all. Translation. It has already been seen that late weaning disposed her more deeply than any other child to wanting to be gazed at and valorized by others. From the age of 5 until the end of adolescence, she devotes all her love to her image. She madly admires her hands, her face, her grace, and she writes, "I am my own heroine." She wants to become an opera singer, to be gazed at by a dazzled public, so as to look back with a proud gaze. But this autism expresses itself through romantic dreams. From the age of 12, she is in love. She wants to be loved. And the adoration that she seeks to inspire only confirms that which she devotes to herself. She dreams that the Duke of H, with whom she is in love without having ever spoken to him, prostrates himself at her feet. "You will be dazzled by my splendor, and you will love me. You are worthy only of such a woman as I intend to be." The same ambivalence is found in Natasha, in War and Peace. "Even Mama doesn't understand. It's astonishing how intelligent I am and how sweet she is," she went on, speaking of herself in the third person, and imagining that it was some very intelligent man saying it about her, the most intelligent and best of men. "There's everything in her, everything," this man went on. "She's extraordinarily intelligent, sweet, and then, too, pretty. Extraordinarily pretty, nimble. She swims. She's an excellent horsewoman. And the voice, one may say, an astonishing voice." That morning she returned again to her favorite state of love and admiration for herself. "How lovely that Natasha is," she said of herself again in the words of some collective male third person. "Pretty, a good voice, young, and doesn't bother anybody. Only leave her in peace." Catherine Mansfield, in Prelude, has also described, in the character of Beryl, a case in which narcissism and the romantic desire for a woman's destiny are closely intermingled. In the dining room, by the flicker of a wood fire, Beryl sat on a hassock playing the guitar. She played and sang half to herself, for she was watching herself playing and singing. The firelight gleamed on her shoes, on the ruddy belly of the guitar, and on her white fingers. "If I were outside the window and looked in and saw myself, I really would be rather struck," thought she. Still more softly, she played the accompaniment, not singing now, but listening. "The first time that I ever saw you, little girl, oh, you had no idea that you were not alone. You were sitting with your little feet upon a hassock, playing the guitar. God, I can never forget." Beryl flung up her head and began to sing again. "Even the moon is aweary." But there came a loud bang at the door. The servant girl's crimson face popped through. But no, she could not stand that fool of a girl. She ran into the dark drawing room and began walking up and down. Oh, she was restless, restless. There was a mirror over the mantel. She leaned her arms along and looked at her pale shadow in it. How beautiful she looked, but there was nobody to see. Nobody. Beryl smiled, and really her smile was so adorable that she smiled again. This cult of the self is not only expressed by the girl as the adoration of her physical person. She wishes to possess and praise her entire self. This is the purpose of these diaries into which she freely pours her whole soul. Marie Bashkirtseff's is famous, and it is a model of the genre. The girl speaks to her notebook the way she used to speak to her dolls, as a friend, a confidant, and addresses it as if it were a person. Recorded in its pages is a truth hidden from parents, friends, and teachers, and which enraptures the author when she is all alone. A 12-year-old girl, who kept a diary until she was 20, wrote the inscription. I am the little notebook, nice, pretty, and discreet. Tell me all your secrets. I am the little notebook. Note, cited by Debesse, La crise d'originalité juvénile, the adolescent identity crisis. Others announce, to be read after my death, or to be burned when I die. The little girl's sense of secrecy that developed at pre-puberty only grows in importance. She closes herself up in fierce solitude. She refuses to reveal to those around her the hidden self that she considers to be her real self, and that is, in fact, an imaginary character. She plays at being a dancer like Tolstoy's Natasha, or a saint like Marie Lenéru, or simply that singular wonder that is herself. There is still an enormous difference between this heroine and the objective face that her parents and friends recognize in her. She is also convinced that she is misunderstood. Her relationship with herself becomes even more passionate. She becomes intoxicated with her isolation, feels different, superior, exceptional. She promises that the future will take revenge on the mediocrity of her present life. From this narrow and petty existence, she escapes by dreams. She has always loved to dream. She gives herself up to this penchant more than ever. She uses poetic clichés to mask a universe that intimidates her. She sanctifies the male sex with moonlight, rose-colored clouds, velvet nights. She turns her body into a marble, jasper, or mother-of-pearl temple. She tells herself foolish fairy tales. She sinks so often into such nonsense because she has no grasp on the world. If she had to act, she would be forced to see clearly, whereas she can wait in the fog. The young man dreams as well. He dreams especially of adventures where he plays an active role. The girl prefers wonderment to adventure. She spreads a vague magic light on things and people. The idea of magic is that of a passive force. Because she is doomed to passivity and yet wants power, the adolescent girl must believe in magic. Her body's magic that will bring men under her yoke, the magic of destiny in general that will fulfill her without her having to do anything. As for the real world, she tries to forget it. In school, I sometimes escape, I know not how, the subject being explained, and fly away to dreamland, writes a young girl. I am thus so absorbed in delightful chimeras that I completely lose the notion of reality. I am nailed to my bench, and when I awake, I am amazed to find myself within four walls. I like to daydream much more than doing my verses, writes another. To dream up nice nonsensical stories or make up fairy tales when looking at mountains in the starlight. This is much more lovely because it is more vague and leaves the impression of repose, of refreshment. Note, cited by Marguerite Evar, L'Adolescente, The Adolescent Girl. Daydreaming can take on a morbid form and invade the whole existence, as in the following case. Marie B., an intelligent and dreamy child, entering puberty at 14, had a psychic crisis with delusions of grandeur. She suddenly announces to her parents that she is the Queen of Spain, assumes haughty airs, wraps herself in a curtain, laughs, sings, commands, and orders. For 2 years, this state is repeated during her periods. Then for 8 years, she leads a normal life, but is dreamy, loves luxury, and often says bitterly, I am an employee's daughter. Toward 23, she grows apathetic, hateful of her surroundings, and manifests ambitious ideas. She gets worse to the point of being interned in St. Anne Asylum, where she spends 8 months. She returns to her family, where for 3 years she remains in bed, disagreeable, mean, violent, capricious, unoccupied, and a burden to all those around her. She is taken back to St. Anne for good, and does not come out again. She remains in bed, interested in nothing. At certain periods, seeming to correspond to menstrual periods, she gets up, drapes herself in her bed covers, strikes theatrical attitudes, poses, smiles at doctors, or looks at them ironically. Her comments often express a certain eroticism, and her regal attitude expresses megalomaniac concepts. She sinks further and further into her dream world, where smiles of satisfaction appear on her face. She is careless of her appearance and even dirties her bed. She adorns herself with bizarre ornaments, shirtless, often naked, with a tinfoil diadem on her head and string or ribbon bracelets on her arms, her wrists, her shoulders, her ankles. Similar rings adorn her fingers. Yet at times, she makes lucid comments on her condition. I recall the crisis I had before. I knew deep down that it was not real. I was like a child who plays with dolls and who knows that her doll is not alive, but wants to convince herself. I fixed my hair, I draped myself, I was having fun, and then, little by little, as if in spite of myself, I became bewitched. It was like a dream I was living. I was like an actress who would play a role. I was in an imaginary world. I lived several lives at a time, and in each life, I was the principal player. I had so many different lives. Once I married a handsome American who wore golden glasses. We had a grand hotel and a room for each of us. What parties I gave! I lived in the days of cavemen. I was wild in those days. I couldn't count how many men I slept with. Here, people are a little backward. They don't understand why I go naked with a gold bracelet on my thigh. I used to have friends that I liked a lot. We had parties at my house. There were flowers, perfume, ermine fur. My friends gave me art objects, statues, cars. When I get into my sheets naked, it reminds me of old times. I admired myself in mirrors, as an artist. In my bewitched state, I was anything I wanted. I was even foolish. I took morphine, cocaine. I had lovers. They came to my house at night. They came two at a time. They brought hairdressers, and we looked at postcards. She was also the mistress of two of her doctors. She says she had a 3-year-old daughter. She has another 6-year-old, very rich, who travels. Their father is a very chic man. There are 10 other similar stories. Every one is a feigned existence that she lives in her imagination. Note, from Borel and Robin, Les Rêveries Morbides, cited by Minkowski in La Schizophrénie, Borel and Robin wrote Les Rêveurs Éveillés, Daydreamers. Minkowski wrote an article, De la rêverie morbide au délire d'influence, From Morbid Reverie to Delusions of Grandeur. Translation. Clearly, this morbid daydreaming was essentially to satiate the girl's narcissism, as she feels that her life was inadequate and is afraid to confront the reality of her existence. Marie B. merely carried to the extreme a compensation process common to many adolescents. Nonetheless, this self-provided solitary cult is not enough for the girl. To fulfill herself, she needs to exist in another consciousness. She often turns to her friends for help. When she was younger, her best girlfriend provided support for her to escape the maternal circle, to explore the world, and in particular, the sexual world. Now her friend is both an object wrenching her to the limits of herself and a witness who restores that self to her. Some young girls exhibit their nudity to each other. They compare their breasts. An example would be the scene in Girls in Uniform that shows the daring games of boarding school girls. They exchange random or particular caresses. Note, a reference to the 1931 German film Mädchen in Uniform. Translation. As Colette recounts in Claudine à l'école, Claudine at school, and Rosamund Lehman, less frankly, in Dusty Answer, nearly all girls have lesbian tendencies. These tendencies are barely distinguishable from narcissistic delights. In the other, it is the sweetness of her own skin, the form of her own curves, that each of them covets, and vice versa. Implicit in her self-adoration is the cult of femininity in general. Sexually, man is subject. Men are thus normally separated by the desire that drives them toward an object different from themselves, but woman is an absolute object of desire. This is why special friendships flourish in lycées, schools, boarding schools, and workshops. Some are purely spiritual, and others deeply carnal. In the first case, it is mainly a matter of friends opening their hearts to each other, exchanging confidences. The most passionate proof of confidence is to show one's intimate diary to the chosen one. Short of sexual embraces, friends exchange extreme signs of tenderness and often give to each other, in indirect ways, a physical token of their feelings. Thus, Natasha burns her arm with a red-hot ruler to prove her love for Sonia. Mostly, they call each other thousands of affectionate names and exchange ardent letters. Here is an example of a letter written by Emily Dickinson, a young New England Puritan, to a beloved female friend. I think of you all day and dreamed of you last night. I was walking with you in the most wonderful garden and helping you pick roses. And although we gathered with all our might, the basket was never full. And so all day I pray I may walk with you and gather roses again. And as night draws on, it pleases me. And I count impatiently the hours between me and the darkness, and the dream of you and the roses, and the basket never full. In his work on the adolescent girl's soul, Mondus cites a great number of similar letters. My dear Suzanne, I would have liked to copy here a few verses from Song of Songs. How beautiful you are, my friend. How beautiful you are. Like the mystical bride, you were like the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley, and like her, you have been for me more than an ordinary girl. You have been a symbol, the symbol of all things beautiful and lofty. And because of this, pure Suzanne, I love you with a pure and unselfish love that hints of the religious. Another confesses less lofty emotions in her diary. I was there, my waist encircled by this little white hand, my hand resting on her round shoulder, my arm on her bare, warm arm, pressed against the softness of her breast, with her lovely mouth before me, parted on her dainty teeth. I trembled and felt my face burning. Note. Cited by Mondus, L'âme de l'adolescente, The Adolescent Girl's Soul. In her book, The Adolescent Girl, Madame Evard also collected a great number of these intimate effusions. To my beloved fairy, my dearest darling, my lovely fairy, oh, tell me that you still love me. Tell me that for you I am still the devoted friend. I am sad I love you so, oh, my L, and I cannot speak to you, tell you enough of my affection for you. There are no words to describe my love. Idolize is a poor way to say what I feel. Sometimes it seems that my heart will burst. To be loved by you is too beautiful. I cannot believe it. Oh, my dear, tell, will you love me longer still? It is easy to slip from these exalted affections into guilty juvenile crushes. Sometimes one of the two girlfriends dominates and exercises her power sadistically over the other. But often they are reciprocal loves without humiliation or struggle. The pleasure given and received remains as innocent as it was at the time when each one loved alone, without being doubled in a couple. But this very innocence is bland. When the adolescent girl decides to enter into life and becomes the other, she hopes to rekindle the magic of the paternal gaze to her advantage. She demands the love and caresses of a divinity. She will turn to a woman less foreign and less fearsome than the male, but one who will possess male prestige. A woman who has a profession, who earns her living, who has a certain social base, will easily be as fascinating as a man. We know how many flames are lit in schoolgirls' hearts for professors and tutors. In Regiment of Women, Clemence Dane uses a chaste style to describe ardently burning passions. Sometimes the girl confides her great passion to her best friend. They even share it, adding spice to their experience. A schoolgirl writes to her best friend, I'm in bed with a cold and can think only of Mademoiselle X. I never loved a teacher to this point. I already loved her a lot in my first year, but now it is real love. I think that I'm more passionate than you. I imagine kissing her. I half faint and thrill at the idea of seeing her when school begins. Note. Cited by Marguerite Evard, The Adolescent Girl. More often, she even dares admit her feeling to her idol herself. Dear Mademoiselle, I am in an indescribable state over you. When I do not see you, I would give the world to meet you. I think of you every moment. If I spot you, my eyes fill up with tears. I want to hide. I'm so small, so ignorant in front of you. When you chat with me, I am embarrassed, moved. I seem to hear the sweet voice of a fairy and the humming of loving things impossible to translate. I watch your slightest moves. I lose track of the conversation and mumble something stupid. You must admit, dear Mademoiselle, that this is all mixed up. I do see one thing clearly, that I love you from the depths of my soul. The headmistress of a professional school recounts, I recall that in my own youth, we fought over one of our young professor's lunch papers and paid up to 20 pfennigs to have it. Her used metro tickets were also objects of our collector's rage. Since she must play a masculine role, it is preferable for the loved woman not to be married. Marriage does not always discourage the young admirer, but it interferes. She detests the idea that the object of her adoration could be under the control of a spouse or a lover. Her passions often unfold in secret, or at least on a purely platonic level. But the passage to a concrete eroticism is much easier here than if the loved object is masculine. Even if she has had difficult experiences with friends her age, the feminine body does not frighten the girl. With her sisters or her mother, she has often experienced an intimacy where tenderness was subtly penetrated with sensuality, and when she is with the loved one she admires, slipping from tenderness to pleasure will take place just as subtly. When Dorothea Wieck kisses Herta Thiele on the lips in Girls in Uniform, this kiss is both maternal and sexual. Between women, there is a complicity that disarms modesty. The excitement one arouses in the other is generally without violence. Homosexual embraces involve neither defloration nor penetration. They satisfy infantile clitoral eroticism without demanding new and disquieting metamorphoses. The girl can realize her vocation as passive object without feeling deeply alienated. This is what Renée Vivien expresses in her verses, where she describes the relation of damned women and their lovers. Our bodies to theirs are a kindred mirror. Our lunar kisses have a pallid softness. Our fingers do not ruffle the down on a cheek, and we are able, when the sash becomes untied, to be at the same time lovers and sisters. Note, à l'heure des mains jointes, at the sweet hour of hand in hand. Psapha Revue. Translation, Gillian Spraggs. Translation. And in these verses, for we love gracefulness and delicacy, and my possession does not bruise your breasts. My mouth would not know how to bite your mouth roughly. My mouth will not bitterly bite your mouth. Note, sillage, sea wakes. Paré, translation, Gillian Spraggs. Translation. Through the poetic impropriety of the words breasts and mouth, she clearly promises her friend not to brutalize her. And it is in part out of fear of violence and of rape that the adolescent girl often gives her first love to an older girl rather than to a man. The masculine woman reincarnates for her both the father and the mother. From the father, she has authority and transcendence. She is the source and standard of values. She rises beyond the given world. She is divine, but she remains woman. Whether she was too abruptly weaned from her mother's caresses, or if, on the contrary, her mother pampered her too long, the adolescent girl, like her brothers, dreams of the warmth of the breast. In this flesh, similar to hers, she loses herself again in that immediate fusion with life, that weaning destroyed. And through this foreign, enveloping gaze, she overcomes the separation that individualizes her. Of course, all human relationships entail conflicts. All love entails jealousies. But many of the difficulties that arise between the virgin and her first male love are smoothed away here. The homosexual experience can take the shape of a true love, it can bring to the girl so happy a balance that she will want to continue it, repeat it, and will keep a nostalgic memory of it. It can awaken or give rise to a lesbian vocation. Note, refer to Chapter 4 of this volume. But most often, it will only represent a stage. Its very facility condemns it. In the love that she declares to a woman older than herself, the girl covets her own future. She is identifying with an idol. Unless this idol is exceptionally superior, she loses her aura quickly. When she begins to assert herself, the younger one judges and compares. The other, who was chosen precisely because she was close and unintimidating, is not other enough to impose herself for very long. The male gods are more firmly in place because their heaven is more distant. Her curiosity and her sensuality incite the girl to desire more aggressive embraces. Very often she has envisaged, from the start, a homosexual adventure just as a transition, an initiation, a temporary situation. She acts out jealousy, anger, pride, joy, and pain with the more or less admitted idea that she is imitating, without great risk, the adventures of which she dreams, but that she does not yet dare, nor has had the occasion to live. She is destined for man, she knows it, and she wants a normal and complete woman's destiny. Man dazzles, yet frightens her. To reconcile the contradictory feelings she has about him, she will dissociate in him the male that frightens her from the shining divinity whom she piously adores. Abrupt, awkward with her masculine acquaintances, she idolizes distant Prince Charmings, movie actors whose pictures she pastes over her bed, heroes, living or dead, but inaccessible, an unknown glimpsed by chance, and whom she knows she will never meet again. Such loves raise no problems. Very often she approaches a socially prestigious or intellectual man who is physically unexciting. For example, an old, slightly ridiculous professor. These older men emerge from a world beyond the world where the adolescent girl is enclosed, and she can secretly devote herself to them, consecrate herself to them as one consecrates oneself to God. Such a gift is in no way humiliating. It is freely given since the desire is not carnal. The romantic woman in love freely accepts that the chosen one be unassuming, ugly, a little foolish. She then feels all the more secure. She pretends to deplore the obstacles that separate her from him, but in reality, she has chosen him precisely because no real rapport between them is possible. Thus, she can make of love an abstract and purely subjective experience. Unthreatening to her integrity, her heart beats, she feels the pain of absence, the pangs of presence, vexation, hope, bitterness, enthusiasm, but not authentically. No part of her is engaged. It is amusing to observe that the idol chosen is all the more dazzling, the more distant it is. It is convenient for the everyday piano teacher to be ridiculous and ugly, but if one falls in love with a stranger who moves in inaccessible spheres, it is preferable that he be handsome and masculine. The important thing is that, in one way or another, the sexual issue not be raised. These make-believe loves prolong and confirm the narcissistic attitude where eroticism appears only in its imminence, without real presence of the other. Finding a pretext that permits her to elude concrete experiences, the adolescent girl often develops an intense imaginary life. She chooses to confuse her fantasies with reality. Among other examples, Helena Deutsch describes a particularly significant one. A pretty and seductive girl, who could have easily been courted, refused all relations with young people around her. But at the age of 13, in her secret heart, she had chosen to idolize a rather ugly 17-year-old boy who had never spoken to her. Note, Psychology of Women. She got hold of a picture of him, wrote a dedication to herself on it, and for 3 years kept a diary recounting her imaginary experiences. They exchanged kisses and passionate embraces. There were sometimes crying scenes where she left with her eyes all red and swollen. Then they were reconciled, and she sent herself flowers, and so on. When a move separated her from him, She wrote him letters she never sent him, but that she answered herself. This story was most obviously a defense against real experiences that she feared. This case is almost pathological, but it illustrates a normal process by magnifying it. Marie Bashkirtseff gives a gripping example of an imaginary sentimental existence. The Duke of H, with whom she claims to be in love, is someone to whom she has never spoken. What she really desires is to exalt herself, but being a woman, and especially in the period and class she belongs to, she had no chance of achieving success through an independent existence. At 18 years of age, she lucidly notes, "I write to see that I would like to be a man. I know that I could be someone, but where can one go in skirts? Marriage is women's only career. Men have 36 chances. Women have but one, zero, like in the bank." She thus needs a man's love, but to be able to confer a sovereign value on her, he must himself be a sovereign consciousness. "Never will a man beneath my position be able to please me," she writes. "A rich and independent man carries pride and a certain comfortable air with him. Self-assurance has a certain triumphant aura. I love H's capricious air, conceited and cruel, something of Nero in him." And further, "This annihilation of the woman before the superiority of the loved man must be the greatest thrill of self-love that the superior woman can experience." Thus, narcissism leads to masochism. This liaison has already been seen in the child who dreams of Bluebeard, of Griselda, of the martyred saints. The self is constituted as for others, by others. The more powerful others are, the more riches and power the self has. Captivating its master, it envelops in itself the virtues possessed by him. Loved by Nero, Marie Bashkirtseff would be Nero. To annihilate oneself before others is to realize others at once in oneself and for oneself. In reality, this dream of nothingness is an arrogant will to be. In fact, Bashkirtseff never met a man superb enough to alienate herself through him. It is one thing to kneel before a far-off god shaped by oneself, and another thing to give oneself over to a flesh and blood man. Many girls long persist in stubbornly following their dream throughout the real world. They seek a male who seems superior to all others in his position, his merits, his intelligence. They want him to be older than themselves, already having carved out a place for himself in the world, enjoying authority and prestige. Fortune and fame fascinate them. The chosen one appears as the absolute subject who by his love will convey to them his splendor and his indispensability. His superiority idealizes the love that the girl brings to him. It is not only because he is a male that she wants to give herself to him. It is because he is this elite being. "I would like giants, and all I find is men," a friend once said to me. In the name of these high standards, the girl disdains two ordinary suitors and eludes the problem of sexuality. In her dreams, and without risk, she cherishes an image of herself that enchants her as an image, though she has no intention of conforming to it. Thus, Maria Le Ardouin explains that she gets pleasure from seeing herself as a victim, ever devoted to a man, when she is really authoritarian. "Out of a kind of modesty, I could never in reality express my nature's hidden tendencies that I lived so deeply in my dreams. As I learn to know myself, I am, in fact, authoritarian, violent, and deeply incapable of flexibility. Always obeying a need to suppress myself, I sometimes imagined that I was an admirable woman, living only by duty, madly in love with a man whose every wish I endeavored to anticipate. We struggled within an ugly world of needs. He killed himself working and came home at night, pale and undone. I lost my sight mending his clothes next to a lightless window. In a narrow, smoky kitchen, I cooked some miserable meals. Sickness ceaselessly threatened our only child with death. Yet a sweet, crucified smile was always on my lips, and my eyes always showed that unbearable expression of silent courage that in reality I could never stand without disgust. Note, the black sail. Beyond these narcissistic gratifications, some girls do concretely find the need for a guide, a master. From the time they escape their parents' hold, they find themselves encumbered by an autonomy that they are not used to. They only know how to make negative use of it. They fall into caprice and extravagance. They want to give up their freedom. The story of the young and capricious girl, rebellious and spoiled, who is tamed by the love of a sensible man, is a standard of cheap literature and cinema. It is a cliché that flatters both men and women. It is the story, among others, told by Madame de Ségur in Quel amour d'enfant, Such an Adorable Child. As a child, Giselle, disappointed by her overly indulgent father, becomes attached to a severe old aunt. As a girl, she comes under the influence of an irritable young man, Julien, who judges her harshly, humiliates her, and tries to reform her. She marries a rich, characterless duke, with whom she is extremely unhappy, and when, as a widow, she accepts the demanding love of her mentor, she finally finds joy and wisdom. In Louisa May Alcott's Good Wives, independent Jo begins to fall in love with her future husband because he seriously reproaches her for an imprudent act. He also scolds her, and she rushes to excuse herself and submit to him. In spite of the edgy pride of American women, Hollywood films have hundreds of times presented enfant terrible, tamed by the healthy brutality of a lover or husband. A couple of slaps, even a good spanking, seem to be a good means of seduction. But in reality, the passage from ideal love to sexual love is not so simple. Many women carefully avoid approaching the object of their passion through more or less admitted fear of disappointment. If the hero, the giant, or the demigod responds to